Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spangin. On today's show... Listener, we have something of an eclectic show for you this week. Coming right up in part one, I'll be chatting to Professor Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University and a former UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Occupied Palestine, about the International Criminal Court, Zionism, and his new political memoir, Public Intellectual. After that, we'll be joined by a stand-up comedian who's taken Hebrew TikTok by storm with his satirical musical takes on the latest news in Israel. He also happens to be a news editor here at Haaretz.com, so we've got a world exclusive of his first English language offering. Please stick around to listen to the very funny Daniel Guri de Lima. Professor Falk, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
In the foreword of your fascinating new political memoir, you predicted that the chapter about Israel-Palestine would be the most controversial one, even before it was published. Were you right?
It's hard to say because so far the feedback hasn't been sufficiently extensive to make a judgment. It was only... published this a few days ago, and the platforms that sell and distribute the book are out of stock mysteriously. So I don't know. I really don't know. I assume it depends who the readers are, and if the readers are the people that follow me on the social media platforms, it wouldn't be the most controversial because they're probably sympathetic with my views on the conflict. But if it was the general audience of what one might call middle America, then it's likely that it would be.
From what other directions might you have been expecting to come under fire, if not on the Israel-Palestine front?
Actually, I was more under fire when I returned from the Iranian revolution in the middle of... I went on a sort of fact-finding visit there during the time when Khomeini was still in Paris, and had a meeting with him in Paris the last day he was there before returning to Iran. But I had spent 2 weeks in Iran before that. And then I had a lot of difficulties of this sort when I returned to the U.S. and was attacked at my university by alumni and also in parts of the media, mainstream media. I was also interviewed a lot because at that time there was not very much access to the leadership, the new leadership. And I had not only met Khomeini, but the people that were in the entourage that took over after the Shah abdicated.
Richard, and there really is such a deep well of material in your book that I'd love to discuss, from Zsa Zsa Gabor to Golda Meir, from Princeton to Palestine. But it would be a crime, no pun intended, not to talk about the International Criminal Court. Were you satisfied with the ICC's decision that it does have the authority to investigate alleged war crimes in the occupied territories?
Yes, I thought it was the right legal decision and a brave and correct political decision. In fact, I had, in collaboration with a couple of members of the Al-Haq legal NGO in Ramallah, submitted an amicus brief that more or less encouraged the outcome that occurred. There were lots of amicus briefs on both sides, including several from leading personalities supportive of Israel's official position, including some of those that had been in the Clinton negotiating team and some people closely associated with AIPAC in the U.S. And some European. The litigation attracted unusual interest in that sense. There must have been 43 amicus submissions, which is more than I've ever seen in any other case at the ICC or anywhere else, actually.
Could that be described as part of the problem of the ICC, that it does attract so much attention, 43 external bodies who aren't directly connected want to chime in on the subject?
Well, this is a unique situation. I don't think the ICC has faced this kind of geopolitically sensitive issue before, except it did have a controversial finding that it could investigate allegations of U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. And that came a few months ago and prompted the Trump presidency to impose personal targeted sanctions on the ICC prosecutor and a few other people on the staff of the ICC. So whenever, as long as the ICC sticks to African allegations of criminality, it doesn't run into this kind of issue. But in these two instances where it took on the countries in the north that, of course, claim they're outside the jurisdictional orbit because they never consented to the Rome Statute, the treaty that governs the ICC. So they're technically not parties to the ICC.
And does that fact that Israel and the United States, but in the case that we're talking about Israel, does that change the equation as far as the legality of the ICC's potential decision, potential investigation is concerned?
Well, that was certainly what those that opposed its assuming jurisdiction argued. And the jurisprudential resolution of that argument is somewhat controversial in the sense that there are no precedents. At the same time, the statute was very carefully negotiated, and what it does is confer authority to act on the ICC for crimes committed in the territory of parties. In other words, if Palestine wasn't allowed to be a party, then there would be no jurisdictional foundation. But given the fact that Palestine was a party and crimes are alleged to have been committed on its territory, which is defined for this purpose as those three areas, West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, that were occupied in 67. So I think the most objective opinion would support the claim of jurisdiction and support the outcome at the ICC.
And what can you tell us about Karim Khan, the Scottish lawyer who's just been elected as chief prosecutor for the ICC? Is it significant that Israel...
I'm curious myself about what to expect.
Right, and Israel cautiously welcomed his election, right? That's that could be a sea change.
It could be, although it could just be an effort to create a contrast with their objections to Ben Suda. Israel's expression of welcome could be a way of conveying their hope that the new prosecutor would treat this issue differently than had the former prosecutor, Ben Suda. And so I wouldn't read too much into that. And in fact, if there was reason to expect a different approach or not pursuing the investigation, Israel would be foolish to have telegraphed that in this way.
And what about the fact that the new prosecutor is from one of these northern powers as you define them.
Yes, I think that's certainly something that would make those that were hoping for the investigation to go forward to be concerned about. But as far as I know, he's pretty much a blank slate as far as those in the UK are concerned. They really don't know how he would handle this kind of challenge.
And possibly even more so in Israel. Richard, in general, can you understand why Israel feels victimized by the ICC and perhaps other United Nations institutions?
Well, I think I think there are two reasons. One is that its record on human rights standards and on issues of this sort is very susceptible to criticism and the sort of allegations that underlie this controversy at the ICC. That, I think that's one reason that Israel's sensitive to challenges to the legitimacy of its existence and to the legitimacy of what it does in the name of security. Mm-hmm. And then the more broad, it also has made frequently the argument that Israel's record, however subject to criticism it might be, is much less susceptible than is the case for a lot of other countries. In other words, it claims that it's being singled out beyond the gravity of whatever wrongdoing it has been accused of. Mm-hmm. And that second reaction overlooks the fact that Israel-Palestine, unlike any other issue before the UN, is an issue where the UN has failed in its responsibility of resolving the conflict. After the British Mandate, it had a unique challenge that it tried to solve through the partition agreement and then through a variety of efforts to find a political compromise. But its failure has resulted in the situation where Israel has successfully established and expanded its sovereign state well beyond the partition resolution, and the Palestinians are living either under occupation, which has gone on, as you know, for more than 50 years, and the refugees are still strewn out around the Arab world. So the UN, in essence, and I've argued this in some contexts, the UN has failed the Palestinians in a very serious way that is untrue of any other global situation.
In as much as it's failed the Palestinians, it's also failed the Israelis in failing to find a solution to what is essentially and fundamentally their common problem. Does this failure invalidate the UN from taking a more active peacekeeping role, or rather, not peacekeeping, that would be putting the horse before the cart, perhaps, in the effort to find peace?
No, I think the efforts of the UN have largely been thwarted by the geopolitical affinity that Israel has been able to make use of with regard to the U.S. and Europe, Western Europe. Without that geopolitical muscle behind it, the U.N. would have had much more leverage. So it's not that the U.N. has tried to do too much, but that it's been disabled from doing enough.
And perhaps limited to a reactive rather than a proactive role.
Yes, and limited to a sort of symbolic role. And that was my experience when I was special rapporteur, that you can criticize Israel, as the Goldstone Report famously did after the incursion in Gaza in 2008-2009, but you can't do anything about it. You can't act behaviorally without the support of the P5, the permanent members of the Security Council. So the UN is limited to this sphere of legitimizing and delegitimizing behavior it cannot modify behavior without this kind of support. It had that support, for instance, when it authorized the intervention in Libya in 2011, and then arguably did much too much given the mandate that it accorded the NATO powers. But with respect to Israel-Palestine, Israel has been shielded from assuming responsibility either under international humanitarian law or human rights law or the diplomatic process that goes back to Security Council Resolution 242 that was passed after the 1967 war. Mm.
Richard, Israel almost certainly won't cooperate with any future ICC investigation. In fact, it's already dismissed the decision itself as anti-Semitic. Has anti-Semite become the new pinko?
Yes. I mean, this is just one further episode in a process that has gone on for at least the last 7-8 years. And I noticed it while I was doing my UN job. Mm. At the beginning, the UN, Israel tried to meet the criticisms in my reports by substantive responses. But after a couple of years, they dropped that and relied on a strategy of wounding, if not killing, the messenger rather than addressing the message. And I think that's been the primary strategy in dealing with critics like myself. And of course, it's an uncomfortable position to have been put in. And whatever else is part of my identity, anti-Semitism, as I understand it, is certainly not part of
it. Mm. Well, if it's any consolation, you're in pretty good company in terms of being accused of this modern anti-Semitism. What about the BDS movement? Is that inherently anti-Semitic? Does it merely contain anti-Semitic elements?
Well, if it depends what you mean by anti-Semitic elements. I don't think it contains any real hostility to Jews as a people, which I take as the core of anti-Semitism. Mm. I think rather it imitates what was done in South Africa with great effectiveness, a nonviolent effort to secure compliance with international law and further the struggle of the Palestinian people for basic rights. That seems to me to be a constructive way of exerting pressure, given the failures of the UN, of the international diplomatic so-called peace process. Pressure from global solidarity initiatives seems to me highly legitimate. And during the South African reliance on BDS, which was controversial, there were a lot of people that said South Africa was a strategic ally in the Cold War. It was a country that should solve its own problems without outside interference. Still, there was never the contention that those that participated in the BDS movement were anti-South African or should be criminalized or sanctioned in any way for their behavior. So it's a different way of trying to discredit external pressure, and I think an unfortunate effort, actually.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you talk a lot about, in quotes, support for Israel. You say, for example, that it went virtually unquestioned within your circles at certain points of your career. Can you just clarify, when you say support for Israel, do you mean for its very existence or for its actions and policies, that kind of blind support?
Well, I think the Israeli narrative was basically uncontested in the U.S. until after the 1967 war. And there was a sense that the feelings about World War II were still active, and the idea that Israel was building a modern model society was accepted. Palestinian existence was more or less erased from political consciousness. It wasn't seen as a dispossession and victimization of one people by another in order to secure their homeland. A people without land for a land without people.
But that's completely changed now. I mean, criticism of Israel is almost de rigueur in some circles, right?
Yes. I mean, it became a kind of litmus test of progressive thought in the last 20 to 30 years. And there was I think Israeli expansionism was one element of this. The degree to which the right wing in the U.S. took on Israel as their ideal model of how a country and a government should act. Trump epitomized this, but it was also true for other conservative leaders like Reagan. And of course, this doesn't undercut the basic relationship of the American establishment to Israel, which has enjoyed this bipartisan consensus, which strengthened after the 1967 war. There became, I think, more of a polarization of perception after the 67 war. Many people celebrated the victory of Israel over the combined forces of the Arab countries and saw this as a vindication of Israel as a David defeating the surrounding Goliaths. But others saw this as a combination of Israeli militarism and joining forces with American strategic ambitions in the region. And it did change the outlook in the Pentagon and in the military and diplomatic establishments in the U.S. that had been somewhat ambivalent about the pro-Israeli policies of the political leaders, thinking that it jeopardized strategic interests in relation to energy and containment of communism and extremism in the region. Only after the 67 war, and then even more so after the Iranian Revolution, did the sort of realist foreign policy establishment come to the conclusion that Israel was a crucial strategic asset in the region, and that this was not just a matter of moral identification or a sense of guilt about not doing more to stymie Hitler in the Nazi period. So there was a definite sea change, and now there's been, I think, a more modest change with many people that had been strongly identified with Israel and Zionism raising questions about whether this was a sensible development. And then the report of B'Tselem on Israel as an apartheid state definitely has had an impact on a variety of people, though it's been dealt with fairly marginally by mainstream media and the so-called liberal Zionist establishment.
Not so in Israel, you might be pleased to hear. And we do talk a lot in Israel, maybe it's just here at Haaretz, about liberal Zionism. Is that an oxymoron in your view?
Not necessarily, though I think it is if you take the basic law as descriptive of the state of Israel, because I do think that does create a framework of one race or people dominating other races, including the people that were displaced and dispossessed.
Mm-hmm.
And that, as I've tried to point out, I don't remember whether I do in the book or not, in the late 20th and 21st century, a dispossessed people in their own homeland will not accept without struggle that kind of change in status. It's not like the colonial era. And one of the extraordinary achievements, in a sense, of the Zionist project was to be able to overcome the decline of colonial expansion from Europe at a time when colonialism was collapsing.
Mm.
It went against that historical flow, and for that reason it had to use particularly draconian methods in order to secure its own existence. That wasn't surprising in a way. It's how do you establish this kind of control in a post-colonial era? And you can only do it by stiff resistance and geopolitical support.
Mm. Richard, in your book, you mention someone who might be familiar to our listeners, American-born Israeli peace activist Jeff Halper, whom you describe as a progressive, confrontational activist, but an unrepentant Zionist. Do I detect a smidgen of respect in your tone?
Yes, definitely. But I think now, if you talk to Jeff, you'd find he was probably a repentant Zionist. See, I think he's lost hope in this two-state solution about a year or so ago, and really thinks that you can't combine the kind of expansion that Israel has engaged in and still hope for a humane and democratic society.
Mm. And a one-state solution could be the answer to you know, liberal Zionists who want to live in a Jewish state.
Yes, obviously. It may be that the tragic era, if one wants to put it that way, of Zionism was insisting on having a Jewish state rather than a confederal state of some kind and a Jewish homeland in that state.
Mm.
See, I think the whole idea that you have a state that is an ethnically defined entity is problematic. And especially if its legitimacy is also tied to remaining democratic.
As Israel defines itself as Jewish and democratic, but that, perhaps that's more of an oxymoron than liberal Zionist.
Yes, I think, well, I think, and it's coming under increasing attack. There's a webinar in a couple of weeks on just this question. Can Israel hope to be both Zionist and democratic? And the main participant is Avram Berg.
That sounds fascinating. Avram was a guest on this podcast just a few weeks ago, and he's really at the forefront of asking those important questions. Richard, can we end on something topical? There are two elections, possibly, on the horizon. Israel's going to vote on March the 23rd, and the Palestinians are due to hold three elections, presidential, general, and parliamentary, over the course of the summer. And obviously, we're a few weeks into the presidency of Joe Biden. Which of those three elections do you find most interesting?
Well, I personally, of course, the Biden victory was the most important to me, and the and in a certain sense more important than the Biden victory was the Trump defeat, because he represented a real fascist threat to the future of American constitutionalism and mobilized a very dangerous, still dangerous movement. Trump is defeated at the moment, but Trumpism isn't. And so the U.S. is still in very bad shape. As for the Israeli election, I think is a personality struggle between Netanyahu and those that don't like him. I don't see it as having very important policy implications, especially on future of Palestinian struggle, so to speak. But I think it's probably important for the direction that Israel takes, which in my observation, which may not coincide with yours, is that Israel has moved further and further toward a right-wing consensus that I find unfortunate for its own internal development, independent of the Palestinian issue.
I think that is empirically true, not just in terms of impression. And for the Palestinians, perhaps just holding an election would be an achievement.
Yes, holding an election would be an achievement. They don't seem to have an obvious unifying leader that I think would strengthen their diplomatic posture quite a bit. But it's likely that they will support a leadership that continues the struggle. In other words, not an accommodating leadership. And the latest I've read, and it may not be accurate, is that Hamas has agreed to the idea of a two-state solution based on the 67 borders. And so you have a certain kind of unity on the Palestinian side, which Hamas had not been willing to, at least publicly, say that in the past.
Both elections, I'm sure, are going to be fascinating. I'm afraid we're out of time. Professor Richard Falk, many thanks for your time. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Well, I enjoyed it, and the time went very quickly, which is a good sign, I think.
And now, listener, for something completely different. I'm here with comedian, rapper, and news editor, Daniel Guri de Lima. Good to have you here, Daniel.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So, listen, I've been really enjoying your Hebrew news raps, Daniel. I'm delighted that you've recorded one in English for us. Which horrific, depressing events are you making light of this week?
Ocean pollution.
Fantastic. What on one leg, as they say? What happened, just in case our listeners...
Well, about 2 weeks ago, there was an oil dump just outside the Israel territorial waters, and it kind of made its way towards our coast, the entire Mediterranean coast. And now we have all these turtles covered in tar shit.
Oh, no. This is obviously perfect fodder for comedy, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. My favorite kind.
How did this come about? You're a stand-up comedian, right?
Yes, I am a stand-up comedian. I've been practicing 4 years now. A couple months ago, the people from the Hebrew social media site, they came up to me because I'm a comedian, and they asked me if I have a TikTok account because they wanted to do a TikTok Hards account. And they thought maybe I had an idea. And a friend once pitched to me, you should do rap news updates, because he knew I started rapping during COVID. And so I pitched it to them, and they liked it, and we did it. And it's been going on for about 2 months now.
Nothing is taboo, right? You'll make fun of anything. There's
We had in the Hebrew, I'm shocked that they let me keep it. I compared the situation in the Labor Party to having Bell's palsy in your face. And they left it, and I loved it.
No censorship.
Nope.
Tell me, is rap usually part of your act when you do stand-up?
No, it's something completely separate, as far as I'm concerned, from my career as a comedian. I can't call it a career because I have to make money to call it that.
Your vocation, maybe.
Yeah.
Your calling as a comedian.
I'll take that.
Tell me, any idea when you'll be back performing in comedy clubs?
No, I've given that up because we shut up and then we went back and we shut up and went back, like, you know, flowers who don't know what's up with the weather. And it kind of broke my heart. So I just stepped away from it and stepped into music for a little bit.
Well, when the clubs are open, though? You'll be going back, I hope. I've seen a couple of your videos on your exchange with Shalom Hanoch was delicious.
That's a once in a lifetime. I can't believe it happened.
That was great.
Thank you.
So listen, as promised, here is a world exclusive of Daniel Guri de Lima's Haaretz.com news wrap. And of course, there will be a link to the TikTok in the episode notes.
The Middle East always so steady with the shenanigans. The people thinking I'm talking Iran again. But today I'm all about the fudge afloat in the Mediterranean. Up and down the coast and it was probably not an alien. Most likely a neighbor who thought it'd be okay to take a dump outside the yard and leave it there to let it bake up into a soggy cake and then he left without a seal. A week later water was looking like diarrhea. Let's talk about that shit. The beaches here converting to turtle for mausoleums. Government muzzles some details so we cannot see them. We know that this ship is weak. Know that this shit is weak cause the government had a plan. Took them more than a week to budget for proper cleaning. So people just volunteering to pick up the trash and some pollution panache. Seeing suicide samurai whales, I just wanna ask. Why not get an iron dome with an anti-tar missile? Because that shit won't win elections, not even a bissel.
Daniel, that was great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Simon. Thanks for having me.
Listener, that's all for this week's episode of Haaretz Weekly. My thanks to Professor Richard Falk, to Daniel Guri de Lima, and as always, to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. For all your election-related chat, please check out Election Overdose with Anshul Pfeffer and Dahlia Scheinlin. We'll be back again next week with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.